Good morning, folks.
Sorry about that.
We'll be back on. Our next docket number is 85946. Do you all wish to retain some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. As you know, the clock will be on the podium and kind of run while you're speaking. When you get to that 3 minute mark, you'll hear the little ding to let you know you're there. Your pleasure. If you want to keep going or go ahead and stop at any time, just let us know when you want to withhold the rest of your time. Okay.
Understood.
All right. And you can start whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Daniel Hansen. I'm counsel for the appellant, Thomas Labs, LLC. The purpose of this appeal is to correct the district court's misinterpretation and misapplication of NRCP 25 and the service requirements surrounding that has been stated in case law by this court. In denying the appellant's motion to substitute, the district court ignored statutory obligations that a decedent's counsel was required to fulfill and improperly shifted those obligations to the appellant. In addition, the district court failed to take into consideration the appellant's good faith efforts to substitute a party in place of the defendant in the matter and failed to weigh that against the defendant's actions in failing to fulfill their obligations to substitute that party themselves. Ultimately, this court should seek to balance the requirements of NRCP 25A with those of NRS 7.075 to ensure that valid cases continue moving forward. There are three primary points on appeal. The first being that the district court erred in concluding that the respondent was not required to serve the notice of suggestion of death on non-parties in order to trigger that 180-day deadline within which to file a motion to substitute.
I'll just ask you a procedural question because I'm a little confused. Mm-hmm. So in March of 2021, there was an unopposed motion to substitute in Jason Hilliard as the trustee.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which was granted.
Yes.
So Dukes was no longer in the case.
The trust was substituted in place of Ms. Dukes, but it was on behalf of the estate for Mrs. Dukes.
Right. So how do we get to a motion to substitute her again when she's already been substituted a year later?
The way that we got to that procedurally, Your Honor, is that the district court, when a motion to dismiss the trust had been filed, it was citing to NRCP 25 stating that the proper party, there should have been a different proper party for the estate. And so the court dismissed the trust in 2022 in an order in January 26th, it was actually May, but in a hearing in January 26, 2022, where it said that the claims against the estate of Mrs. Dukes remained in place, that the suggestion of death needed to be served on her successors, and that a substitution should be filed for that estate to bring in the proper defendant. And so that was following the court's interpretation of NRCP 25 at the time, that the estate still had the claims brought against it, and that the case should move forward against the estate, just substituting in an administrator instead of the trust that contained all of her assets.
I'm guessing, and obviously she'll correct me if I'm wrong, but because I have the same confusion. I think one of the things Justice Bell may be getting at is that when the judge granted an unopposed motion to substitute and put Hilliard and the trust in, that replaces Dukes individually. She's gone. So once the court then dismissed the case against Hilliard and the trust, it would seem to be that everything the district court did thereafter should be void, because that party wasn't there any longer. And that's even assuming the court got it right, which is in question, obviously, about who's supposed to file the motion to substitute anyway.
The interpretation by the district court was that the trust represented the estate of Mrs. Dukes. And so for that reason, had placed the trust in the place of the estate and continued the case forward against the estate, but just in the name of the trust itself. And that's seen by the district court's ruling that was issued in January 2026 when it stated explicitly that the claims against the estate would continue forward. And the basis for dismissing the trust, even though it was still appellant's contention that the trust was the proper party, was that under NRCP 25, the trust wasn't, and there should be an administrator in place instead. And so whether or not the court was correct in that, that was the court's ruling at the time. And so the appellants moved forward with getting an administrator in place, with taking probate action and substituting that probate in place. Now, we definitely take issue with the fact that this was an unopposed motion to substitute that was granted, but the district court may have misinterpreted that as well under NRCP 25 in determining that the trust was not the proper party.
But regardless of who the proper party is, Ms. Dukes had passed away and couldn't be a party in the case anymore.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, under NRS 41.100 and NRCP 25, it states that that individual, the estate of that individual, remains a party until
a party substituted in place. But not Ms. Dukes herself, except that Ms. Dukes herself continues to appear as a party in the case. So I'm really struggling to just understand factually what happened here, let alone legally.
that seems to be more of a case caption issue with Ms. Dukes, and it was really the estate of Ms. Dukes that had been replaced. The case caption was adjusted to the Hilliard Dukes Trust with Mr. Hilliard as the trustee of that trust. But the district court recognized that as the case was continuing forward against the estate of Mrs. Dukes, and that's what really was at issue. And in the motion to substitute that had been granted, what was pointed out to the court was that the trust possessed the claims of the estate, the assets of the estate, and so that's why the court felt that it was proper at that time to substitute the trust in place. And so the appellants, they proceeded with good faith based on that court's ruling and moved forward with discovery, moved forward with ensuring that they were able to have those claims and have all of the information surrounding those claims and move to trial. Now, it was the January 26, 2022 issue or order from the court that really changed the tables on this one. It moved it from being the trust to an administrator needed to be put in place for that trust. And in addition to that, Your Honor, going back to these issues on appeal today with the suggestion of death, the requirement was that suggestion of death needed to be served on non-successor parties. Non-party successors to the estate. And that's an important issue here. It's important. It comes up in Goner versus Dale, where this court points out that in order for a motion to substitute the 180-day deadline to be triggered, a counsel for the decedent must file a notice of suggestion of death and serve it on non-party successors and representatives. This is important to trigger that 180-day deadline. And even in this case, there was that unopposed motion to substitute. If, in fact, the trust had been the improper party, under NRS 7.075, the decedent's attorney had an affirmative obligation to substitute in the correct party. And that's not what happened here. Instead, there was simply a motion to dismiss stating that it wasn't the correct party and that a new party needed to be added in place. And in addition to that, on November 30th, 2021, more than 10 months after that initial suggestion of death was filed, there was an amended suggestion of death that should have restarted that 180-day deadline. Well, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the only thing that changed in the amended suggestion of death was the place of death, right? So would that really restart the deadline?
It is. It will, Your Honor. And the reason for that is the place of death represented an issue with concealing information with regard to the location of the assets, location of potential successors for Ms. Dukes. And when you couple that with the fact that the notice of suggestion of death was never served on non-party successors, it becomes a big issue. And with also the fact that the amended suggestion of death was filed more than 180 days after the initial suggestion of death was filed, it'd be rendered meaningless unless it restarted that deadline. And you could potentially see issues where you have a defendant file a notice of suggestion of death, include information that they didn't need to, such as the name of the successor, have that successor appointed, wait 180 days, and then file an amended suggestion of death and with a new successor and claim the prior one wasn't proper, the clock shouldn't restart, and the case should be dismissed. The importance behind NRCP 25, NRS 41-100, and 7.075 is the legislature indicated that valid causes of action should continue forward. There shouldn't be tactical maneuvering or gamesmanship to try to destroy a valid cause of action. And so in that case, and taking that intent in consideration, when an amended suggestion of death is filed, that corrects misinformation or misleading information in that initial suggestion of death, then it should be sufficient to restart that 180-day deadline, especially if it's filed outside of past 180 days from the initial notice of suggestion of death. Now, to address an issue under the service requirement, I pointed out Goner versus Dale, and I'd also like to point to McNamee in 2019. In 2019 in McNamee, this court still upheld that proper service is required in order to trigger that 180-day deadline. McNamee did create a narrow exception to this service obligation, and not to the service obligation, but to the notice of suggestion of death. In McNamee, the court overruled a federal or a case that followed a federal standard from 1985 called Bartow, where the name of the successor had to be included in the notice of suggestion of death. And so McNamee stated that that reached too far. However, it still provided that that notice of suggestion of death needs to be filed on non-party successors in order to properly trigger that 180-day deadline. And there are two important reasons for filing or for serving non-parties with that notice of suggestion of death. And the first is that individuals who have a financial interest in this estate have a right to be notified that the estate has a lawsuit against it or a lawsuit in its favor. And so this is an important point where the decedent's counsel should be notifying the successors of this ongoing case. And the second issue is requiring service of the suggestion of death supports the requirement in NRS 7.075 and ensures that the decedent's counsel is taking action to fulfill their responsibility to substitute a party in place within the 90-day requirement. Moving to our third issue, Your Honors, the motion to enlarge time for substitution. This court has repeatedly in Mosley and in other cases pointed out that a motion to substitute should be liberally construed and that it can be brought within the 180-day time period and even outside of the 180-day time period if there's excusable neglect. And some issues that the court will look to are what were the efforts made by the appellant who's requesting that enlargement of time? And also what were the efforts taken by the other party? Did they assist in filing that motion to substitute and bring in the correct party, or did they obstruct? And here in this case, you have the appellant who within 60 days of that initial suggestion of death had to speculatively identify the successor party and move to substitute. That substitution was not opposed and time continued forward. It was granted by the court. The appellants acted in good faith, reliance on the court's decision, and continued all the way through discovery on the case. When the party was dismissed from the action, the trust, and the estate was in place, the appellants then immediately reached out to personal representatives who should have been served with this notice of suggestion of death to determine who would serve as that special administrator. From that point on, within 2 months of the hearing from the court stating that the estate was in, they filed a probate action, had a special administrator appointed, and requested that that special administrator be substituted in within 3 days after the probate court appointed them. On the other side of this, you had the defendants, the deceased family members who, after there was an administrator appointed, moved to have themselves substituted in as an administrator and refused to. Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but is it your position that the 180-day period has never started, even up and through today?
That's correct, Your Honor. Based on the service requirements, the 180-day requirement would not have begun. And part of the reason for that is Ms. Dukes did have a will. She also had a trust. The trustee should have been served, and the personal representatives named in the will should have been served. And it was her counsel that was in a better position to identify those individuals. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Driscoll.
Patrick Driscoll, bar number 10877, on behalf of respondent. May it please the court, Your Honor. The district court got it right. The court reviewed the McNamee decision. There is no additional requirement for a suggestion of death to be served on additional, potential, or other non-party successors to trigger the start of the 180-day clock.
So can we go back just a little bit before we get to that, because I really want to try to understand factually what happened. So there was a substitution. There was a substitution on March 21st.
Yes.
It was unopposed. So
absolutely.
How do we get to the point that then there is an unsubstitution and a dismissal because there wasn't a timely substitution?
So the substitution isn't just whether or not you substitute in a party. It's substitution of a proper party. And the issue is the court allowed in the improper party.
But how do you raise that issue now when it wasn't there was no opposition to that person being substituted in at the time that it happened?
That's correct. And just because they came in, that doesn't make it that they were the correct party, which is why a motion to dismiss was later filed.
Did you possess the knowledge of who the correct parties were at the time of the substitution or at any point before the case was ultimately dismissed?
Well, we know under NRS 41-100, the only proper parties are administrators or executors of an estate.
Right. Did you have that information in your possession? I know a copy of the will was eventually
I didn't have
produced.
A copy of the will until, I believe, January, discovering that it was filed in November. It was not provided to me.
So under 7.075, isn't it the obligation of the lawyer of the decedent to make sure all of this happens?
I would absolutely agree that's the clear reading under S7.075, and had it ever been brought to my attention prior to the appellant's brief, I would have had additional time to see how it happened. The simple fact of the matter, that was never once argued.
But you knew she died.
I knew she died, but I didn't know that there was an obligation under 7.075 that the decedent's attorney had to substitute in the proper party. I'd also note that that was a 1989 statute.
I think we can understand. None of us know all of the laws, right?
Yeah.
But that's the law, and it's a shall. I mean, it's not a discretionary. It's a shall do these two things. So understanding that, how could the court, this isn't you, this is the court, the judge just kind of ignored that fact seemingly and just moved forward without kind of addressing the fact that there is a statute that says it was your obligation to have filed and served these things?
Well, I believe under the statute, to address it, it has to be brought forth to the court by motion. The second part of the statute says the court may, upon motion, impose sanctions if it considers appropriate, including costs and fees against an attorney who fails to comply. It was never brought to my attention, never brought to the court's attention.
So if Thomas Labs filed a motion to substitute, which they did not have an obligation, so it was not statutorily their obligation, but they're just trying to make sure things get taken care of, they filed a motion, there is no opposition to that motion, the motion is granted, why would they do anything?
Your Honor, again, the obligation when you're substituting in a party isn't just any party. It's the proper party. And that's what the court went forth and explained ad nauseum in the Goner decision, is you have to open up an estate. And it says, you know, this might take time, but because of that, if you need more time to open up the estate, file a motion and ask for more time. That's the proper procedure. Nevada specifically deviated from the federal requirements. And it specifically said in McNamee that this applied interpretation, because the clear reading of the statute does not require the notification of successors. The proper procedure is you open an estate, notify anyone that you do know, and if the court looks at any kind of probate work, it doesn't require that you have a list of all the heirs, just list the ones that you can possibly understand, and give the court an understanding on why jurisdiction needs to be opened, and the court will appoint somebody, and then you appoint that person into the case through the motion to substitute. It doesn't matter if who does the substitution. In fact, I think that's an important balance here.
Does it? Does it not really matter? Because it would seem to me that, just being very frank here, that the appellant here was trying to collect a debt that they feel they were owed by Ms. Dukes. They get a notice that she's passed away. There is no motion to substitute filed by the party that logically would be in the position to know who should be substituted in. So they try and do that. And then all of that essentially gets used against them later. And so doesn't it really, yes, matter who should do the substitution? And isn't that the statute says you're supposed to do the substitution? And quite frankly, ignorance of the law is no excuse for not following the law. It's not their obligation to go to court and say, hey, we've never got this substitution. It's your obligation of representing Ms. Dukes to have followed and figured out what the law is that applies.
And I understand. And that goes to a allocation of burden. And I would state that the actual true burden lies on the person who's trying to proceed and process forward a claim.
But where in 7.705 does it place the burden on anybody other than you to file the notice of death and a motion for substitution and serve those things?
Again, it doesn't. But I'd also note to the court that the last time that statute was looked at and reviewed was 1989, and NRCP 25 was in October of 2019 in the March of 2019.
Okay, hold on. So when we're looking at, in the grand scheme of things, right, statute takes precedence over a rule to the extent there's any conflict, right? Always. It doesn't matter when the statute came into effect. Statute first, then rule.
I understand. And what I'm seeing here is that there's a conflict. And I've also looked forth to see how the court analyzed 7.075 and all of the progeny before McNamee, Garner, Bartow, even the federal cases, Rende. None of them actually go through any kind of analysis on 7.075. They all look at the party who's trying to keep the case alive, whether that be the plaintiff, defendant, or counter-defendant, for the purposes of getting the motions to substitute done, because the penalty is a dismissal of all claims for or against. And in this case, I would put forth to the court that there's actually a conflict in interest in trying to keep the claims alive on the part of the appellant when the decedent obviously wanted those claims to be dismissed in this case. There's an inherent conflict of proceeding and taking a step to preserve the opposing party's claims being imputed onto the decedent.
But there's a statutory requirement to do that.
I would agree that the clear reading of the statutory requirement was there. It was never once argued in the lower court. And I do believe, based upon that, it's improper to try to bring it up on appeal. Justice Lee, I believe you had a question.
Yeah, and I thought that 7075 was addressed below, but I'll go back into the record and look further. But it looks like your client didn't seek to have anyone substituted or intervene until appellant had Barry as a special administrator was through the probate court, got this other person appointed. I mean, they were jumping through hoop, try to get the proper person. So there was not a lack of effort, but my question was that that's the first indication that I see in the record is in June of 2022, where Barry was actually appointed. And then there was a motion filed to remove her and replace her. And even in that instance, the appellant said, hey, we'll just stipulate to replace her. And we don't care who the administrator is, we'll stipulate. But there was a refusal to stipulate to even that on this side. So I don't know what efforts there were to comply with 7075 prior to them actually getting a special administrator appointed.
Very clearly, Your Honor, again, there weren't efforts to comply under 7075 because it was never once discussed. If the court would want to look at the record on appeal and the entire record, Your Honor, the only reference to 7075 was on an unreferenced exhibit in an opposition to a motion for summary judgment in a advisory committee note on the copy and paste of a statute. It was never once argued ever on the underlying record on appeal.
Perhaps we could turn to the issue of service. So under Rule 25, the motion, statement noting death must be served in the same manner as a motion, which is on parties and non-parties. So do you want to address that?
Yes. First off, the non-parties are people that would be required to be served. And the question as to who those are was answered in the McNamee decision, where they said, we overrule Bartow to the extent that it concludes that a suggestion of death emanating from the deceased party must identify the deceased party's successors or representatives to trigger the 90-day deadline to file a motion to substitute. So the allegation that there's other non-parties to serve, not there, it doesn't exist. That was overruled in McNamee because the clear ruling of the statute is what the court was following. And NRCP 25.
Well, a successor would be a non-party, though.
But who would the successor be that that would be served at the time of the death? The successor in interest would be the person who's been appointed by a court under NRS 41-100 that hasn't been appointed at that point in time. So when you file the suggestion of death, the argument would be is you have to open up a probate matter and then have someone appointed before you could ever file a suggestion of death. And that's not how it was ever applied in any of the underlying cases. In fact, if the court looks at the underlying suggestions of death submitted in Barlow, Goner, Mosley, McNamee, none of those suggestions of death named these purported successors in interest because they don't exist at the time of the filing of the suggestion of death. Very briefly, I just wanted to address the court's denial of the excusable neglect. And I'm going to steal from the Tory Murrow decision that did define excusable neglect, that it's not because of a party's carelessness, inattention, or disregard of the court's process, but because of some unexpected or unavoidable hindrance, Your Honor. In this case, the 180 days ran. The court found that they ran by the time the motion to dismiss was filed. The first request for additional time, even though they were notified in November of 21, the first request for additional time wasn't filed until middle of May of 22, 5.5 months later. The court's process was to open up an estate. That process wasn't followed. Instead of following the proper court's process, they decided to add in the trust because that's where they, on the record, they said that's where her house is, that's where her assets are. They wanted to follow the money, not the law, by opening up an estate.
Which was not opposed, again, so.
But that doesn't make it the proper party under the statute.
Oh.
But under an excusable neglect, let's just talk logically, under an excusable neglect analysis, should a party be entitled to rely on a district court's prior decision in the very case that this is coming up in as a basis to excuse them having not done something that apparently it's proposition that they should have done?
That would be shifting the burden onto the court instead of the parties making the court a fact finder as to what the appropriate party is. And I don't
know. It's just saying, okay, district court made a ruling that I was allowed to do something. And then later on, the district court said, nope, that was wrong. So, okay, I'll redo it. Is that excusable neglect for not having done it right in the first place that the court told you what you did was right?
No, and I understand that. And that's why I started my analysis at the time of the motion to dismiss, because that's when they were notified that they did it wrong, because it wasn't the proper party. And at that point in time, you'd start the analysis of saying, what did they do to fix it? Did they ask for more time right away? No, they didn't. They waited until May. Did they open up an estate right away? No, they opposed it and fought it and said, no, we have the proper party. We have the estate. We have where the money's at. We want to keep this here. They didn't open the estate until March, and they didn't file any kind of paperwork to substitute until May. It wasn't any kind of proper process to get it done. And most importantly, they weren't trying to substitute in a proper party at that point. This was an issue that was litigated in the estate case, but specifically, they were trying to substitute in a coworker or paralegal, putting them on both sides of the V, where they would have their office be the representative of the estate sitting at the Duke's table, and then also sitting over at Thomas Labs would be counsel for the appellant, creating an unavoidable conflict. It wasn't the proper party, and the good faith requirement is one of the most important factors in excusable neglect. So they couldn't show that under these facts, and the court set that forth in its decision on the opposition to the motion for reconsideration.
I just have, can I just also, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I'm clear on your position on service, because in the Goner case, that it looks like we adopted Barlow, which is a federal case, right? Because NRCP 25A1 and FRCP 25A1 are identical. And it's in Barlow, which we have adopted, held that the time period is triggered by two affirmative actions, right? One, a party must formally suggest the death of the party upon the record, which you did. Second, the suggesting party must serve other parties and non-party successors or representatives of the deceased with a suggestion of death. And those are both mandatory prerequisites to trigger the 180-day time period. So how do we get around that here?
Okay, so I could be very specific because I did have to clarify this. The court didn't follow the federal rule in the Goner decision. The court specifically was citing to Barlow and said that the federal rule is this, but the state rule is different. And then that was clarified the following year in McNamee. And again, Barlow predates McNamee. McNamee was very, very clear because it's talked about that the worry about this was because of the burden shifting from the deceased party to the other side trying to keep the claim alive. And that same language was included in the McNamee decision. That actually goes all the way back to the Stoddard decision that they were citing from the Utah case. And that basically showed that they were no longer following that. And there was not any requirement to have additional people notified.
Let me ask you this. Just a real simple question. If I know you are opining today that 7.075 wasn't raised below, but assuming it was, assuming it's in play for us, and it says what it says, would you concede, same question I asked opposing counsel, that the 180 days hasn't started running if we apply 7075?
If we're applying 7075, then the...
Did you ever file a motion for substitution?
No, I never filed a motion to substitution, but the 180 days is triggered by the suggestion of death, not by a motion by the decedent's counsel. And so the requirement, again, under NRCP would be a dismissal. And then any kind of remedy at that point would have been to file a motion under 7075 saying decedent's counsel didn't substitute in the proper party. And therefore, there's sanctions available for failing to do so.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And we will add a couple of minutes to council's time since we went about 3 minutes over here. Two, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Three quick points on rebuttal, Your Honors. First, just addressing the service issue. It was brought up that the court followed the Stoddard decision in Utah when it looked to McNamee. And Stoddard, Utah actually permits a plaintiff to just name an estate without naming a successor. And so it's a different set of rules that we're operating under. And that's been rejected by other jurisdictions, such as Colorado. They reject that same language and said, no, service is required because you do have to provide this notice and the decedent's counsel should follow that provision. Without that service requirement, there'd be no purpose, or without the court following that service requirement, there'd be no purpose to the NRCP 4 language within NRCP 25. And NRCP 25, Goner versus Dale, Barlow have made it very clear that service must be made on non-party successors. And to briefly address the non-party successor issue, it was suggested that this would be the entire state of Nevada, when that's not so. Federal courts have looked at this, they've addressed it, and they broke it down into three categories. And one was non-parties with legal authority to step into the decedent's position, non-parties with a significant financial interest in the estate, and then obviously interested parties such as a spouse or a mother or father who should be served with this notice of the suggestion of death in order to trigger that 180-day deadline. Now, NRS 7.075, for one, it's inextricably intertwined with NRCP 25. There's no way for this court to interpret the meaning of NRCP 25 without also considering the statutory requirement. And in addition to that, we brought it up in the motion for summary judgment, reply and support, the motion to substitute and clarify, and the reply in support of that, and cited to the advisory committee notes, which begins with NRS 7.075 is an integral part of NRCP 25. And so this court would have to, in order to comply with the legislator's legislative intent, follow the language of NRS 7.075 when interpreting NRCP 25. The third issue, and one other note on NRS 7.075, is it has been cited in cases before this court, such as Brass v. State, which addressed NRS 7.075 favorably. In fact, this court has repeatedly followed the federal requirements that are set up, except for McNamee, where it said the name of the successor doesn't have to be included in that notice of suggestion of death. McNamee didn't overrule the service requirement. It still maintained that proper service needed to be conducted, especially in a case where you have a decedent with a will and with a trust. The individuals who would need to be served are readily available, readily apparent to the decedent's counsel, and necessary to be served in order to comply with NRS 7.075. Lastly, Your Honors, as far as the enlargement of time, in this case, even if the court got it wrong in dismissing the trust, the court still chose to follow NRCP 25 and require the parties to follow that statute with regard to service. Within 180 days of the amended suggestion of death being filed, the appellants moved for or requested an enlargement of time to have an administrator appointed. The district court did no analysis whatsoever on excusable neglect, did no analysis as to the defendant's actions in this case, and that was a clear error by the district court. Given the totality of the circumstances in this case, the court should have favored allowing valid claims to move forward rather than mechanically implying a 180-day deadline for a notice of suggestion of death that was never served on any non-parties. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. All right. Thank you both. I appreciate your time today. I appreciate the briefing. Sometimes these can be very complicated and nuanced cases, and so it's always good to have oral arguments. So thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.